Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. How did I
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Come get some.
Beware, I live.
IGN Gamescoop.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN Gamescoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. This is Justin Davis.
Hey!
Ryan McCaffrey.
Greetings.
And Brian Altano. And our topic today comes from viewer Birch Miller.
Birch?
Yes.
Cool.
It's
a good tree.
He thinks video games today need to be providing us with more options. Maybe a strange topic, but let him explain. Let him explain. He says, your discussion about the death animations in the new Tomb Raider game reminds me of something I've been asking for years now. A few weeks ago, we were talking about those very grisly death animations in Tomb Raider. Why don't developers give users more gameplay options? Developers need to realize, he's calling out these developers. These developers need to realize that this generation wants all the customization they can get. I mean, is that true? Is that, before we go any further, is that true? What is this generation wants all the customization.
I mean, that's absolutely true. Like, okay. It's a big thing with even gamers younger than ourselves that, you know, customizing your iPhone faceplates. I get Xbox faceplates were never a thing, but
they were $15. That was the problem.
Weren't they even more? They were like $20, I feel like.
The way that the kids these days accessorize and, you know, no one wants to just have like the same. Like when I was growing up, everybody had to have a starter jacket. That's what you had to have. But now, like.
With the NFL team of your choice embroidered on the back?
For sure. But you could also, it was a team of your choice, but you had to pick one of these three teams. You sucked.
The Raiders?
Well, I mean, not where I was.
The
It was the Packers.
Anyway, let's continue on.
What are we
now, doing? You could say that adding options will change the gameplay, but if it's optional, then what's the big deal? So here are a few ideas of things that might make games more interesting.
All right.
So he wants, for example, he wants there to be a mode without enemies, like in Uncharted or Bioshock. He says, sometimes I just want to look around and find items. Why not give me the option of exploring a world without the tedious job of shooting people? Journey, anyone? But like, that's not an option.
Well, also,
in the game, that's the whole game.
Yeah, it's not like there was a shoot people mode in Journey.
Yeah.
Like if you, well, he's talking, that's what he's saying. It could be like Journey.
Sure.
But if you find that if it's a tedious job to shoot people in Bioshock, maybe this is not the game for you. Like,
Well, you know, this whole thing just takes me back to early 90s games. You know, like Doom, one of my all-time, like, that's one of my five Desert Island games, right? Because you can play Doom over and over, and, you know, it's got easy cheat codes. IDDQD, God mode, IDKFA, all guns and weapons.
Sure.
And you could just turn on no clipping mode and just fly through the levels if you felt like it.
It's more common in PC games, right?
Yeah.
I feel like.
So we were teasing Birch a little bit, but I don't necessarily disagree. I mean, I think that, you know, there used to be, when you finished a game, there would be lots of stuff to go back and do. Like GoldenEye was full of, you know, cheats and codes. And Doom, like you're talking about, SimCity. I feel like if you beat Bioshock, I mean, why not give people the option? Maybe almost nobody would like it, but how much time would it really take to implement a mode where, sure, just like run around Rapture and you don't need to worry or be stressed out about it?
So, yeah, kind of what he's talking about is basically a debug mode, right?
Yeah,
like, pretty much.
I think it's called a museum mode in some cases. And yeah, I mean, most games don't have it, which is kind of interesting. Most games kind of provoke you to clear out an entire area of enemies and then go back and find everything. But that's because the gameplay in that game is really most importantly killing people and then going back and finding crap and not just finding crap while people are shooting at you. You're like, leave me alone. I'm trying to find some treasure. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
I think that should be a bullet point on the box. Exciting killing people and going back and finding crap gameplay.
So I think the unfortunate real answer to this particular scenario is that even implementing anything in a game these days requires it to be tested and go through certification, even if it's part of the game. Like, games cost so much money now and take so much time that...
So much money that even if you sell 3.5 million copies in 3 weeks, it's considered a disappointment.
Yep, they not enough.
They need to revise their own internal expectations, but that's a topic for a different game scoop.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Games are so complex and the team sizes are so large that it's super easy for us to sit here and be like, just remove the enemies. How hard could that be? But, like,
it actually
you don't know,
is.
Like, since these games are so scripted, like, maybe some enemy being in place, like, by removing it, you're breaking something else.
Right.
And so you would need a whole QA team to run through that. There's right, some feature that the vast majority of people don't care about.
Exactly. I mean, that's the sad reality that didn't exist in the 80s and 90s, right? You could just flip on that stuff, and it was a lot easier to get away with.
Yeah, so like Birch wants access to, the game options. You know, he wants to open up, go behind the curtain, right, of the game and explore all this stuff. But that's sort of like, how do you balance that with the experience that the developers are trying to create? Right?
Valid point.
Yeah, I think that's, you totally nailed it. I think that kind of breaks it a lot. It's the same thing as a movie. You want to stop the movie and you want to see what's on the back of the set and how this costume was made. Yeah. And you get extras and DVDs and Blu-rays and
stuff
like
that. You watch them afterwards.
Sure. And you get things like that. But to stop the game and be like, hold on, Zach Morris time, freeze everything, spin the whole level around, see how the stilts and everything are holding everything up. It's too much. And I think games now more than ever are these really kind of highly guided experiences, especially because they're just it's cost so much money, we put so much time into this environment and these characters, we want you to just go through this scripted section or loosely scripted section and experience it the way we want you to experience it.
I can't speak for a Ken Levine, but BioShock Infinite being the hot game of the moment, would Ken want you to be able to peek behind the curtain? I would venture to guess probably not.
But then that leads me to think, well, what's more important, what Ken wants or what the person who bought the game wants?
Sure. I mean, that's a fair point. And that's why, we've sort of been explaining why this isn't a great idea or why maybe Birch is a little off base. But he's right about, this is your product, right? Let people have fun with it the way that they want to have fun with it.
Sure.
You know, the example, I think I've talked about this on GameScoop before, is Cliff Bleszinski once said that if an easy mode is still too hard for some gamers, you failed. You need to make your easy mode basically impossible to fail, because if someone's playing on easy, that's what they want to do, right? And so let people play the game that they want to play the game. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that sentiment necessarily.
I think there is a certain level where developers have to stop listening to the people playing their games and just pull the trigger on their own decisions.
Sure. BioWare listens to their fans way too
much. I think even Nintendo with Smash Brothers or something like that, people are put in Sonic, put in this guy, put in that guy, and they do it to a certain extent, but I mean, eventually you're going to have a character roster that's every video game character in
history. What other creative medium is like that? If the fans don't like the last song on the new Radiohead record, sorry guys, we'll record a new song.
Yeah, we'll remaster the record without that.
Yeah, they fly out to the studio, they redo the whole thing. We sent out some new versions of that album ridiculous.
I think a lot of that stuff can happen. I wish there was more to do in games when you beat them. You beat Tomb Raider, I'm kind of done with Tomb Raider. I wish I could restart Tomb Raider in New Game Plus.
What about multiplayer?
Play around with it.
No, I'm kidding.
So I think about, if you had a lot of this stuff, let people access all the weapons from the start. Let them just play around with game settings. And I'm going back to GoldenEye as an example, because that unlocked this menu where you could give the enemies 200% health and do if you beat that game on the hardest difficulty, it unlocked all these options.
Well, what was wonderful about that game too is that the difficulties weren't just enemies were tougher. They had tiered objectives.
Well, sure, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, which I mean, that was just something else to give you more incentive to keep playing.
Yeah.
Just a few other ideas that Birch has here for options. He'd like to be able to remove death animations in Tomb Raider and Resident Evil. Make it optional. I don't know why.
So that's
sort
of like
tired of seeing those death animations.
I guess he just wants to restart faster.
Yeah, maybe.
Is that it, or does he not want to see? Because the other option is the blood code.
Either way.
Where you take away all the gore and you take away all the death. And
that seems like it would be easy, since it is an animation that just begins.
Yeah, just cut it off.
Yeah, just like.
Skip it.
Yeah,
just. He also said swearing, right?
Well, he'd like the option to remove swearing. He says, maybe people have kids.
A lot of games do actually have that option.
Gears does.
Do they?
Yeah, Gears of
War
does.
What, you can beep it, or what?
I think it just
puts clown noises over everything.
I just feel like that's actually extra work for the developers, right?
Yeah,
you record your dialogue now. You can't just remove certain words.
Yeah,
you have
two
to
audio
now
tracks.
You go in and that's actually extra work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with any of that. It's games used to have blood on off. That's something that's kind of gone away these days. I mean, I think it's kind of if you have the option in there at all to have the blood, then your game's already getting the M rating.
Yeah, so that's the weird thing. It's like, hey,
so why are you buying it for your kids in the first place?
Yeah.
You're in the store and you're like, I want that game, but can you take the chainsaws and turn them into umbrellas? And just play Mario at that point.
The thing about Tomb Raider is that game's really violent. Like, Uncharted is Uncharted rated M or is it T?
I want to say it's T, but maybe it's him. We don't know.
If it is, the bottom line is Tomb Raider has a level of violence in it that like Uncharted doesn't
have.
That's
true. Yes.
And like it wouldn't take that much to dial it down to be more Uncharted style. Like just take out the crazy kill animations. Like take out some of that.
Well,
like the absolute stuff that pushes the limit, and then suddenly you have a game that's much more sort of Uncharted's level of
the whole
violence.
First couple hours of the game though are about Lara's struggle with.
That's true.
With that, adjusting to that violence, and of course, there's the big scene where she first to do that.
How do you sell these things, though? You put up a box that says Tomb Raider for sensitive people, and you have to go buy that, and you're like, you go to school, and you're like, oh, which version did you play? And like, the sensitive people.
I can't stand cursing. You can give people the option in the game.
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. But you're absolutely right. In the case of Tomb Raider, that's actually a poor example, because that violence serves a purpose.
Like, but there are plenty of examples.
Yeah.
It's like saying, I'm not going to watch this horror movie until it's on... You know, channel
it's been edited
five.
For, yeah, it's on. I want to watch the airplane version.
Yeah, I want until it's on a plane. It's like no one. It's like, oh my god, he's gonna. Oh, next scene, he's fine. Yeah. Like that's just a weird thing to me. Some games are violent games because they're violent games. Like we can't. It's like saying I want a E-rated game to have violence options.
That would be. Can I
like,
add
Kirby
violence?
When he inhales a guy, he spits out his blood and guts, and he's like, yeah. Fucking killed you.
like the Goomba, when you stomp on a Goomba, he gets just like a letter sent to his family. Like.
Well, there was a video going around a couple months ago that was like, it was Super Mario Brothers, but with like next gen rated M sound effects, and he would land on a Goomba and just like, and he's like, oh! And he's like, jumping and running. It was like disgusting. It's like, I don't want to play that game. That's awful.
Birch wants to be able to access minigames anytime after they're discovered. Like in Far Cry, if you want to play like the knife throwing game, you have to drive.
Totally,
to the lab.
Totally. Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm generally in favor of once someone's beaten the game and played it the way that the developer wanted it to be played, yeah, give them the keys to the sandbox. Why not? Yep. You know, it gives people more reason to come back.
Bring back sound tests. Those were fun.
I love the sound
tests. Those were
tests.
Really fun.
You can hear all the sound effects.
You like, just play them like, for hours, just messing around.
That's kind of a retro game thing. You used to be able to listen to every individual sound effect, every music track in the game. I thought that was awesome.
I don't think that's shown up in a game in 15 years.
No, because you'd have like 15 straight ones of Lara Croft going like, ah!
That'd be awesome.
And you just have to keep in those...
There's like 100 different shotgun blast sounds you hear.
Oh, they gotta bring that back. That would be so cool. Yeah.
That would be really good.
I think I need to time my jump right. Like, shut up. I know. I just haven't gotten it right yet.
You see, Justin, this turned out to be an interesting topic.
Oh, yeah. I was skeptical.
You were skeptical about this topic
really?
Today. Thanks, guys. And thank you, viewers. Remember, you can always reach us at gamescoop@ign.com. Stay tuned for more video game discussions right here on IGN Gamescoop. Welcome back to GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. This is Greg Miller.
Hi.
Mitch Dyer.
Japan.
Colin Moriarty.
Hello.
And Colin, last week during the Game Developers Conference, you had the opportunity to talk with Keiji Inafune.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mega Man.
Yes, yes.
As they call him.
Third time I've gotten to meet him, yeah.
Was it still sweet as the first?
It was. It was. Sweeter, even.
Did he remember you?
Yeah.
Whoa. Jinx.
Yeah, he did. He did remember.
Now, you asked him, you know, obviously it's very well known that the Xbox failed to launch in Japan, figuratively speaking. It did actually
It took
launch.
Off and then just crash landed.
You asked him why he thought maybe it didn't take off. Two Xbox consoles in a row failed to catch on in Japan. What did he say?
Well, I want to preface that by saying he was actually here to just, like talk about Soul Sacrifice, and I just totally derailed the conversation to talk about other things because I thought that was... He's too interesting to talk about one game. Yeah. You know, he says things, you know, like he'll talk. And he's not like a PR bot at all. And so I wanted to ask him about this. And I never heard from anyone specifically why they think, a Japanese person, why they think the Xbox hasn't launched well in Japan. And it was always assumed that it was because it was not Japanese. And he basically confirmed that he thinks that the game didn't have exclusives, which I don't really agree with. Actually, Microsoft went out of their way to make a lot of exclusives in the beginning.
Blue Dragon.
Yeah, exactly. Specific hardcore RPGs. And games still come out there from time to time, but he basically said that it's because Sony and Nintendo are Japanese and that they are more likely and liable to support their domestic products there, which doesn't also account for why Apple is successful there.
That's the thing I wanted to bring up. You know, when I first started going to Japan maybe 10 years ago, they had smartphones that were light years ahead of what we were using, you know, here. But now you go to Japan today and everyone's just using iPhones and iPads, so they'd have no problem accepting that American-made product.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I think he's right, but I think that it's in the console space or the gaming space, they might feel different maybe about some other products or whatever, but yeah, I mean, I didn't get into it too deeply with him about Apple, but...
So obviously, you know, the Xbox is very successful here. Me personally, I don't think, I really like the Xbox because it's American made, you know?
But that's really what's under the surface for you, I bet.
No, I don't think so. Do you think, if Japanese people have that mindset, is that mindset also shared by Americans? Like, do they want it, like, they like it because it's an American made console?
I doubt it. I mean, I think that as Americans, you and I from the Midwest, we're pretty ignorant about everything. I bet a lot of people probably don't even know that the PlayStation is not. It's like, what? This isn't an American company? Like, I think we are very accepting as a nation, right, of this global ecosystem, right? There's in Back to the Future. Mm-hmm, Marty tells Doc the best stuff comes from Japan. Or China, wasn't it? I forget which one it was.
All the best stuff is made in Japan.
So,
it's about Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
That leads us to the question, you know, Microsoft is about to unveil the next Xbox. We don't know exactly
when.
We don't know exactly when, but we know.
You run out.
I've got to go.
Coming soon.
Yeah.
Probably this month.
Probably.
Yeah.
Will they, should they even release that console in Japan?
I think they have to. I mean, Microsoft has been very adamant about global launches, even if it's not necessarily the same day, right? The Xbox 360 did launch to Japan, I think a month, maybe less, after its release in North America, hit Japan, failed miserably, sold like 100,000 units in its first month, and then just kind of tailed off, and now it's sold like 1.6 million to date in Japan, which is like 0.02% of the total sales of that console. That's insane. That is, business-wise, that's terrible. Yeah, like, but don't do that again.
You just said they have to.
Yes, yeah. I think they have to. I think they can't afford to let that market go. They cannot afford to let Sony monopolize that next-gen console market.
You can't admit defeat.
Why? They don't have it now.
Sure, but I think they still need to try, especially now because the Xbox 360 took so long to get a lot of even third-party Japanese releases, right? Like we have Resident Evil hitting the 360, Resident Evil 5, Resident Evil 6. I think as time goes on, you're going to see Microsoft try to adopt more Japanese stuff earlier. We saw the attempt with Blue Dragon and Lost Odyssey. Maybe a little bit too late, probably not enough. Looking forward, you have to think that if they're going to release in Japan, which I think they will, they have to have a strategy.
There's a tipping point. I do. I mean, you have to go out there. We're talking about like how accepting I think America is right now of global consumerism, right? You have to keep trying to bring that to everyone else, right?
Why?
Because you want to be a global company, right? You want to be something that appeals to the most people. You want to have stuff. I mean, it's all about games. It's that's how it speaks, right? That's what Mitch is talking about. If you're going to launch the Durango Box 2012 and you bring it out and it's going to have great games, then
Durango
people are going to want
to... Durango Box 2012.
Catch it.
TM.
In 2012?
Well, it's about its power. It's not about the year.
But if you try to infiltrate a market for 10 years... and it never catches on. Why not just say, well, maybe this is...
Maybe Microsoft has now identified what it is, whatever it is they're doing that leads them to fail in Japan. Maybe they've identified, hey, that thing that we did that led us to fail twice in a row, let's not do that. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it is the domestic thing that Inafune talked about. Maybe it's the software. Maybe it's the hardware. Maybe it's...
I mean, don't you want everyone developing... I mean, we keep talking about how this is probably the last console generation and we're moving towards this unified thing. You want everybody making or have the chance to make games for your system. If you're not going to put it out in Japan, you're not exposing it to developers and you become...
See, that's not true because the console market is bigger in the West now than it is in Japan. So sure. I think Japanese developers would still want to develop games for, you know, and sell them in the West.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Inafune was saying, was that, like, at Capcom, like, they never thought about making exclusive games ever because that's not how they make money. They understood it's, like, something, in Japan is something like 15% of the console market. So it's, like, it's a readily shrinking market in terms of worldwide global consumerism, especially as emerging markets open up in Brazil and other places in Central and South America and in Eastern Europe. Those are huge markets that, frankly, PlayStation is going to dominate, I think. The PlayStation's already huge in Brazil. It's huge in Eastern European markets. And what I think you're going to find if Microsoft wants to launch in Japan is that they're going to do it because they feel like they need to save face there.
Exactly.
Xbox sold about 2 million units there. And Xbox 360 is going to fail to even reach those numbers. So not only are they not selling, they're actually the numbers are actually declining. And you can say that that's within the context of a shrinking console market there, which it is, because the handheld market and the mobile market there is huge. One thing I think people are missing out on is that Xbox started to emphasize Kinect a little bit, which is basically impossible to use in a Tokyo apartment.
It's like San Francisco.
Yeah.
And there's just less space there. People are on top of each other, especially in big cities. If the new Xbox really emphasizes motion control, it's really going to sink that console there, I think. And I do think Microsoft will launch the system there, if anything, just to be like, well, we're going to lose money again on this, but we have to do it.
Microsoft is Microsoft, and I can't imagine them being able to sit there and eat crow and be like, you know what? Japan doesn't want us. We don't want them.
We're out.
You know, like, there's no way they're going to do that. But that's an excellent point. I didn't even think about the fact that how we hear about how the new Kinect or whatever is going to be such an integral part of the next.
I think the assumption there, though, is that Kinect is going to be exclusively motion-based, right? Like, we hear Kinect, we think dumb dancing garbage. But realistically, I think what the Kinect is going to be, especially if it's built in or mandatory or whatever it is, it's going to be a lot of voice stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the large support of it. It's going to be mandatory because they want you to use it. But I don't think there's going to be as much of an emphasis on like motion-controlled games that would, you know, impact a very small apartment.
Sure.
It would definitely be very unusual for a new console to launch and then not launch in Japan.
Yes.
But I just don't see that how that would benefit Microsoft. I don't think they need that market. Also, the Xbox is built around this like entertainment center hub idea of the living room, and there's all these services on it. Like, I watch Netflix and Hulu Plus and HBO Go, and I have no idea if those services are even available in Japan. So it's like, what if is it just about games? Okay, well, now they don't have any games that appeal to the Japanese market, right?
Yeah.
I think worst case scenario, like the way I see it going, is Microsoft launches globally as rapidly as they can, if not day and date, like November 22nd, 2013, we launch on in every territory with the Xbox 3 or whatever it is. Or they launch in Japan a month later like they did before. But the way I see it going is they have that initial shipment go to Japan, and then that's how they gauge their success. If it sells out, great. They ship more. If it fails miserably, they back out again and say, well, you know, we tried. Third time, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah. And so see, I think focus elsewhere. For me, it strikes me as a bullet point on your presentation checklist that
we're
launching in
every territory. And how much? Give that up.
How much? I don't. You know, I'm not a businessman. I don't know if you've caught on. I don't know how much you actually lose. How much it costs to ship those consoles to Japan to have them there?
It's not even that though. Like the thing you have to think about is like Microsoft needs a presence there to support Xbox, and so this is going to cause them to have scores of employees in office. They're going to have to translate things. They're going to have to localize everything. They're going to have to get those services that Damon was talking about.
Marketing campaign.
Yeah. I think they're going to do it. Like I do think they're going to do it, but they're going to lose money, and PlayStation 100%. 4 is going to trounce it. I mean, like, and we all know that already. So it does like kind of beg the question why, like Damon's asking. I think that's a totally valid question, but I think Microsoft's too big and too proud to say that, you know, we're gonna give this to our biggest competitor, who might actually take it to us everywhere else in the world too. And you don't want to, because you know, it seems like things could be shifting if these guys kind of diverge, which it seems like they are. And Microsoft's going in this direction, Sony's going in this direction. Only one of them can win. But I think the interesting thing that we're not thinking about too is that Wii U is like failing miserably. And so this, you know, it's in like Sega Saturn territory, and whether it is, I mean, just that's not a judgment call. That's what the data says. You know, like it's in bad shape. It's selling worse than the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox have ever sold, and they're 6 and 7 years old. So that also removes like another, unless Nintendo really gets behind it and relaunches this thing, which they might. You never count Nintendo out. But that removes a component from the market in Japan in which that might give an angle for Microsoft to compete with Sony, because no one really looks at Nintendo as Sony's competitor right now in the console space. PlayStation 3 is going to win that race with Wii U right now, and PS4 obviously is going to win that race in Japan as well. And while DS is really, or 3DS is really killing the Vita, and the Vita's kind of doing okay, but not really, there's a little space there for Xbox to carve out its niche again. But this is an economy of scale, man, and like if you can't sell lots and lots of games, then it doesn't pay to bring a console over there. So it's a question of business dynamics, but I also think it's a question of pride. And I think it's the latter that is going to get Microsoft in Japan, probably with Xbox, I would say, not worldwide, but probably in 2014 they'll launch it there.
Yeah, like we were saying, we do expect the next Xbox to be announced this month, so we should, you know, have more information on what Microsoft's worldwide launch plans are very soon. But thanks, guys, and all for you. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for more video game discussions right here on IGN GameScoop. Let's check in with the listeners.
Hey, listeners.
Listeners, remember you can always reach us at the email address gamescoop@IGN.com, just like Jake Banks did.
Are they viewers now?
Yes, but for tradition's sake.
All right, yeah. Greg. Just saying, man. You gotta upgrade sometime. Like, stay by the bell, the new class.
Let's check in with the viewers.
Hey, viewers. You
wanna say that now?
Yeah.
I don't know. That just doesn't seem
right.
Hey,
game scoopers.
No. Well, yeah. No? Weird. Anyway, Jake Banks writes in today. He says, hey guys.
Hey.
Was just wondering if you guys could shed some light on something for me. Whenever a new console is coming out, I tend to think that games that are released on both the new console and the console it's just replaced tend to be less next-gen and more like just a prettier version. Is this true, or would there be considerable differences? Now, he words
That's
his
a
email.
Walkabout. It's just like you're reading, like, you hear the gears breaking.
Wording is a little awkward.
We phrased it well question. Back here, actually.
Yeah.
Bridging right, the generation gap.
Yeah. We came to that.
High tech.
That's what I did.
What he's talking about is, you know, when a new generation of consoles rolls around, there are some games that are released on both the current and next-gen platforms,
right.
And sometimes they seem like they're just the same game, the next-gen version is just a little prettier. Yeah. He's asking if that's the case, and for the most part, yes.
Yeah, that is so the case. I've been covering the Xbox since the dawn of time, and when the 360 came out, I actually coined a term for this. You can check it at the trademark office. It's there.
I hope that's true.
You get a nickel every time someone says it.
Exactly. So here's the nickel number one for today. Hawkware, ladies and gentlemen.
Hawkware.
So Tony...
I think I need some Tony Hawk's American Wasteland.
American Wasteland, yeah. Tony Hawk's American Wasteland was a game that shipped in 2005 for the Xbox, for the PlayStation 2, and probably the GameCube as well. I don't remember.
Nobody played Nintendo back then.
Anyway,
really different, night and day nowadays.
When the Xbox 360 launched in November of 2005, Tony Hawk's American Wasteland came out for the Xbox 360 as well. It was the exact same game running in 720p instead of 480p and with achievements for $10 more. Same game, no texture difference, no nothing. You were paying $10 more basically for achievements. Right. And worth it. We would come to find out that yes. But yeah, so I started came to call this phenomenon Hawkware.
Nice, that's I like good. That. For me, the example's always Madden, right? I remember Madden came to 360. I didn't buy a 360
at
launch.
Remember that trailer?
Yeah. You're like, oh my God, this is blowing my mind. This is going to be the best Madden ever.
That was target footage.
Was it? Yeah, okay. You've done your homework.
Yeah, I did.
I did an article for the paper I was working at. I went to this place where you could play games, and they had like, you know, marathon gaming sessions. And I played it there, and I put it in, and I was like, this is terrible. Like, this is all. Their modes were missing. The announcements were horrible.
It looked amazing, but features were missing that were in the PS2 and Xbox versions.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that one didn't work out.
The one for me that always stands out is Gun. Because I really liked Gun on PS2, and then I heard it was coming to 360, and I was like, I'm going to replay Gun, and it was the same game.
It was exactly the same as Tony, same developer even. It was never soft. It was the same thing.
Never soft.
$10 more, same game.
So it had like the higher res stuff, but even then it was, the character models were the exact same, so having them in higher resolution kind of spotlighted.
Didn't go well.
They were not flattering. It kind of made the game look a little bit worse in some ways.
Right. Yeah.
Play the game on PSP.
Another couple examples were Need for Speed Most Wanted, and then King Kong. Peter Jackson's King Kong, the official game of the movie.
That was a big achievement game back then.
Two other games just finished it for the thousand points.
Yeah. There was also Splinter Cell Double Agent was a totally different game on 360.
That's a perfect counterexample. Yeah, that's where...
I'd love to see more of that this gen.
That was done by two completely different development teams. The lead platform on that was the Xbox 360 version, which was the only version at the time, done at Ubisoft Shanghai. But then Montreal did a totally separate current-gen version, Xbox and PlayStation 2. Same story, different missions,
basically a Chaos Theory.
The current-gen version was better. That's the hidden secret.
Yeah.
So history tells us that, for the most part, you know. So when they're planning their launch lineup, they'll have a couple, two or three exclusives that are just on that next-gen system.
Sure.
They're supposed to show off what it's capable of. But for the most part, you know, most publishers out there don't get the development kits early enough to really create a game that's going to... Plus, the install base isn't going to be very big on the
new system. Making money for them. A third-party developer has no allegiance to PlayStation 4 or to Xbox 720. They want to make money. So yeah, they already have this game. And how hard is it to port it over? All right, port it over. Whatever. Up-res the textures and let's just do it. We want to make as much money off this property as we can.
I think we're going to see a lot more Hawkware.
Nickel.
You don't get paid by yourself. That's not all right.
Just walk around saying it all day.
If I say it enough, it'll become true.
Right? Okay.
But yeah, I think we're going to see it a lot more with this transition than we did going from last gen to this gen because the stakes in development now have just escalated so much. Development costs are so much higher. And, you know, we're seeing developers shut down when games sell a couple million copies, and sorry, that wasn't enough.
We missed our projections. 6 million wasn't enough.
So I think we're going to see a lot. To the reader's question, the viewer's point, I don't think we're going to see this next generation's potential fully tapped for at least
for a
couple
while.
Years.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because the visual disparity between current gen and next gen isn't going to be that much. I mean, it will be noticeable, but not to the degree of PlayStation 2 to PlayStation 3.
Sure.
No. You can only go from the standard def era to the high def era once.
Exactly.
The real question, I think, is like for tech, when we're talking about like Watch Dogs, right? Everything they show for Watch Dogs and talk about Watch Dogs is, you know, you're going to be able to use your iPad to spy on your friends while they're playing and do this, and this is happening, and it sounds awesome, but that sounds super next-gen. That sounds like the PlayStation 4.
Well, you know what it sounds like is always online. It sounds very similar to this thing that everyone is up in arms about right now, which is are the next-gen consoles going to be always online? When you look at something like Destiny, when you look at something like Watch Dogs, when you look at something like Battlefield 4, all of these games appear to be reliant on some kind of connectivity. Whether that's going to be the case, we'll see, but to your point, it sounds next-gen, and that, to me, sounds next-gen, always being.
And so what does that mean for the PS3 and 360 version of that game?
Right, like are they feature...
Everything you've been promised for Watch Dogs, right? You're going to sit down, you're going to buy it on PS3, throw it in, and it's going to be like, nope, that's all
next-gen
stuff.
That doesn't look like the TV commercial video I saw.
Yeah. I can't hack ATMs.
I was trying to come up with a list of a few games that we know are going to be coming this fall, and I couldn't come up with that many. There's Assassin's Creed 4.
Yep. Yeah. That's the big one.
And we know.
Battlefield.
You can bank on things like Call of Duty.
Exactly.
Well, there was that rumor that Ghost might only be for next gen, which is crazy. Which is crazy talk.
That is
crazy. Throwing away money.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah. Ubisoft and Activision typically support console launches pretty well. They have some.
They do.
EA does okay.
But then there's Destiny. Destiny is a little sort of a unique example, I think, right? Like, I think from the beginning it was planned to sort of live on both ecosystems, right?
Yeah. From what I can gather, and this is just my own speculation, I think the game experience will be pretty well the same on both, but I do think that the technology is going to be, it's going to look and run at barely acceptable levels on 360 and PS3, because really, you know, this is a franchise for the next 10 years, and the 360 and PS3 are just sort of going to be around
when that game
for
comes
the next
out,
couple.
When that game comes out, the Xbox 360 will be 8 years old.
Yeah. How crazy is that?
Right? Yeah.
8-year-old tech. These people are still making games for it. And Ubisoft is very open. I talked to Ubisoft, and they said that we will continue to make games for the current gen after the next gen is out, because there's money there.
Right. Yeah.
PlayStation 2 games continue to sell even after PlayStation 3 was out.
Right, and again, it goes back to the stakes being so high in developing and publishing now. You're not going to see a situation where, with Microsoft, where the Xbox One, even up to the end, they were taking a loss on every box sold. So they cut the original Xbox off at the knees on purpose. They said, okay, well, no more games for this thing, we're done. But this time, the 360 is on autopilot, and it is a service-based machine as well as a games machine. It's definitely going to live on for the next few years, and we will see games for it. But yeah, I think it's going to take a year or two before we get more than just high-res port-ups, by and large. Right.
Yeah, with E3 coming up in the not-too-distant future, we'll know, you know, what games are going to be coming out this fall, and we'll start being able to put together a list of what Hawkware.
There you go. Now there's a nickel.
Making that money.
My kid's going to go to a great college. I can tell already.
The old nickel college.
You know, it's interesting when I was doing some research for this. I looked back at the PlayStation 2 launch, and at that time there was a lot of games that were released, and most of them were exclusive to PlayStation 2. They weren't like Hawkware ports that were both PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2. I think sometime during that generation, some business-minded person at Microsoft or publishers were like, you know, not many people are going to have a 360 at launch. Let's just put the game out for both systems. So I think that's a relatively new development.
It is. You're right. It is the corporate mentality, the strategy has definitely changed.
Well, at the PlayStation 2 launch, if you want to keep on the Tony Hawk example, Tony Hawk 4? 3? 3. I think Tony Hawk 3 came out around that time. Was a completely different game on PS2, GameCube, and Xbox than it was on PS1 because they kept releasing Tony Hawk 3 and 4 on the PlayStation 1, and they were totally different. They were very traditional. Just here's a small space in a skate park. But on PS2, it's like they were, you know, for the time, like living worlds. There were people around. They were assigning you quests. You were in public places with people walking around a mall and stuff. It's like, what is this world? It's totally different for Tony Hawk. And they were very different games.
Thanks for the question, Jake. Viewers, if you have your own questions, send them to gamescoop@ign.com and stay tuned for more video game talks right here.
Here? Somewhere?
Here.
It's moving.
Here.
It's all moving.
Like right there.
Here. Here. Here.
Oh.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to Season 1, we are thrilled to announce the launch of Season 2. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make Season 2 even more memorable together.